After our week-long holy hiatus for the diocesan priest retreat, we pick up where we left off in our study of Pope St. John Paul II's Theology of the Body. Several miles ago in this now long walk with Jesus, I shared that when I prepare young couples for marriage, I break down that complex 6-month process of marriage preparation by saying we fill, in effect, 3 buckets. The first bucket we call the paperwork. The second bucket is the heart work, the hard work. And the third bucket I refer to as the wedding work. All the details and the drama of the big wedding day. As he turns from chapter 1 to chapter 2 of part 2, Pope St. John Paul II also directs our attention to the wedding work. Or more precisely, the wedding vows and the subsequent sexual consummation, which he appropriately entitles the dimension of the sign. The dimension of the sign. Why? Well, the sacramental sign of marriage consists not only in the union of hearts, but also in the union of bodies. But frequently, the bride, or more often the mother of the bride, becomes a bridezilla. That is, she gets so caught up in the externals, the dress, the flowers, the photography, the reception, etc., that she all but forgets the internals, the meaning of the vows, the lifelong commitment, the unspoken language of the body, the witness to divine love, etc. In this third bucket of the wedding work, John Paul II does not want us to miss precisely these internals, or rather the spirituality of the wedding day. And he does this by demonstrating how the theology of the body becomes body language. Incidentally, in chapter 2, we also find those 31 extra pages that did not form part of the Pope's original material on the theology of the body. In the interest of other pressing papal priorities, John Paul decided to excise portions of his rich reflections on the Song of Songs and Tobit. Michael Waldstein, the Pope's translator, supplies both the excluded and the included material in his version of John Paul's masterwork, Man and Woman, He Created Them. Waldstein explains why he enlarged the papal book in this manner. Pope John Paul II had originally prepared 6 catecheses, those are the Wednesday general audience addresses, on the Song of Songs and 3 on Tobit, on the basis of the pre-papal book manuscript. For actual delivery, however, John Paul II cut the original text to less than half by marking which paragraphs were to be read. In this edition, Waldstein's edition, the 2 versions, the delivered and the undelivered, are printed synoptically on facing pages. So, whereas the Pope's book only contained 53 pages in chapter 2, Waldstein's edition contains 84 pages. Who knows, maybe by adding duplicating pages, Waldstein could charge more for his editor's cut edition. In every culture and civilization, social intercourse is governed not only by written, codified rules of engagement, like the U.S. Constitution and traffic laws like stop at a red light, go at a green light, but also by unspoken, assumed mores or etiquette. For example, here in the United States, people would be appalled or offended if someone burped while eating supper. Indeed, parents scold small children who think burping at the table is funny and attention getting. But in other cultures, China, India, Turkey, and generally in the Middle East, people consider burping, even belching, after eating, a compliment to the chef. What is traditional and valuable in Asia is taboo and verboten in America. Many years ago, while I was vocation director, I visited J. Peter Sarton, our bishop, at his Episcopal residence in Little Rock. We were having a very engaging conversation, and Bishop Sarton is always an attentive and jovial interlocutor. At several points, I noticed, however, he made a slight yawn, but I shrugged it off, figuring maybe he's a little tired, but I feel fine, so I kept talking. Later, I learned that a polite yawn is a signal that it's time to wrap up the conversation and go home. I completely missed that unspoken social cue, the unwritten but critical rules of social intercourse necessary for healthy and happy relationships. In chapter 2 of part 2, John Paul wants to teach us the highly valuable yet unwritten rules of engagement based on the wedding work. He zeroes in on how the words that the couple utters in the wedding vows are later expressed eloquently in the language of the body, especially, although not exclusively, through sexual intimacy. In every true marriage, therefore, a couple has to show evidence both of the words of marriage and later the works of marriage. In Latin, ratum et consummatum, ratified by the words and consummated by sexual intimacy. In a sense, John Paul does not want married couples to miss their social cues for a healthy and happy marriage, like I missed my cue with Archbishop Sarton. The Holy Father maintains further that when these two essential aspects of married life, the spoken vows and the unspoken body language, are seamlessly combined, the married couple stands before the world as a sign of God's grace operative in the sacrament of marriage. Don't forget that John Paul titled this chapter "The Dimension of the Sign." In other words, their wedding words and work constitute a sign language, not only to each other as husband and wife, but to the world, indeed to the cosmos. John Paul asserts, at the moment of contracting marriage, the man and the woman, with the suitable words and rereading the perennial language of the body, form a sign, an unrepeatable sign, which also has a future-oriented meaning, quote, all the days of my life, unquote, that is, until death. This is the visible and efficacious sign of the covenant with God in Christ, that is, of grace. Put differently, the theology of the body helps us to interpret or translate the marital language of the body, the couple's wedding words and works, into the sign language as the sign of heavenly grace. And thus, these words and works of love alert us not only to the mores prevalent in Manhattan or Milan, but rather the etiquette essential for life in eternity. Praised be Jesus Christ.